Hello and welcome to Millennial 2018. Now, before I'm here with the Great Order. This is the first episode. It's with the Great Order, Jared. But before we get to that, it's obviously a good idea to tell you some news, some s items, get them out of the way at the beginning of this series. And the first thing to say is I'm a wee bit ill. It's nothing serious, just a head cold. So if I sound, not optimal, that's the reason. But it's hopefully it will be clearing by the as this series progresses. Now what else? Now, okay, I wanted to make a video. Some people will know that there was some I went through some stress, some trouble a couple of months ago, and I wanted to make a video sort of addressing that and thanking everyone for being so supportive at the time. But because I've been so busy arranging Millennial, I didn't have time to do that, so I apologize. But I did take all the advice to heart. I read every comment that was posted under the Acedia and Crisis videos, and it meant an awful lot. And I mean, that's a trivial thing to say, but it is the truth. But I don't want to dwell on it too much here because this is obviously supposed to be a positive thing. Now, what else? Sorry about the delay in publishing the Millennial schedule, but people were quite slow at responding and booking slots, several people, so I won't name them obviously, but that sort of delayed everything. I apologize for that. It was annoying because I'd like to have had the schedule up a week or even 2 weeks ago, but it just wasn't possible. Now, there are going to be this is going to be the biggest Millennial so far. There are going to be 72 hangouts at least. There might be more added to that schedule as it progresses. That happened last year. I think maybe three or four, or maybe more than that, hangouts were added to the schedule during as it was going. What else? There was something about this that I wanted to say. I've forgotten what it was. So it'll no doubt come up in my discussion with Jared from the Great Order. Now, one thing I should certainly say is the live chat is going to be quite strictly moderated. Do not mess around because it is serious. It lowers the tone for everyone else and possibly endangers things. So just use common sense and try to be constructive. All right. Is that everything I wanted to say? I think it is. 72 hangers. Yeah, so it's going to be a lot. It's going to go for over the next 2 weeks, so from now until Christmas Eve. So let's get on with it, and I'll start with Jared from the Great Order. Welcome to Millennial, Jared.
May I say, first, hello, everybody. It's good to be here, and thank you so much for doing this. I'm glad that we're going to be able to kind of celebrate and put this in context for this first episode. I don't know, I can launch right into some thoughts I have on what Millennial is itself, if you'd like.
Absolutely do that. I mean, I should say that there was a reason that right, you made a very when I was banned from Twitter 2 months ago, you made a very supportive video about that, and part of that video was talking about Millennial. So I thought you've obviously got thoughts about this, even though this is only the fourth year. I mean, it's not like it's an ancient hallowed tradition. It isn't, but it is. It does seem to be becoming something. And so I thought that you would be an appropriate guest to have on as the very first guest. So yeah, please go ahead and talk about it. I don't expect gushing praise or anything. I'm just interested in what you have to say about this.
Well, it's like an opening ceremony. I feel like there should be trumpeters and girls dancing behind me. Maybe this
How do you think
backdrop
I feel?
is inappropriate. No pressure, no pressure. Well, I will say this. I'll talk about millennial, but for me personally, any of you that know of what I'm doing, especially with my friend Jason of No White Guilt and our own show, The After Party, that all came to be because of Millennial 2017, 1 year ago. So Jason and I became aware of one another through Millennial. We spoke in the early part of the year and started communicating. And long story short, that's what led to the after party. So I can show you, I can demonstrate in my own life that you have brought people together. I'm sure we're not the only story, but this is kind of a focal point. It's a gathering of the tribes, so to speak. And a lot of good things come out of that. To speak about it more broadly and put it in perspective, I said this to you last year when I was just starting out and you were gracious enough to have me as a newbie. And again, you know, we see that a lot of good things, dominoes kind of fell from that, from my being on Millennial. And I'm sure you help out a lot of other people in that way. We were talking a little about what this time of year is, what Yule is in general. And we were connecting it, well, maybe a little bit intimating towards this, but we can maybe develop this more now that we have the time and the space to do this, is that this time of year, there's a reason that our instincts, those of us who are of European descent and who come from these northern latitudes, there's an instinct to stop and reflect. It was, the harvest is over. Our ancestors had a long winter ahead of them. You know, maybe there was a feast to use up some of the food stores that wouldn't last the winter. So, hey, well, might as well eat a lot of it and then save, you know, what you had for the winter. You knew there was going to be a long, lean winter ahead of you. And that is where we have the need for certain rituals and certain focal points, certain celebratory days that are not like others. And we have kind of these holidays dotted throughout the year, throughout the calendar. I personally think that we need to get back in touch with more of those old folk holidays and the folk calendar throughout the year, but that is maybe a bit of a different topic. For this specific time of year, we needed each other's warmth, both literally and figuratively, to survive, and we would be around each other more. So this is a time to kind of collect together, and especially the symbolism of the light being low and the darkness. This is the darkest time of the year before the winter solstice. And then there's the return of the light of the winter solstice. That is one of those focal point days. In fact, for a lot of our ancestors, it wasn't just one day. That's where we get, in modern parlance, you might hear the 12 days of Christmas and things like that. But these come from older forms. I know that, speaking of the very first millennial, one of my favorites and one of the more influential ones on me is actually when you spoke to Survive the Jive, Gra, and Yarnifer from the Wolves. And you guys spoke about Saturnalia and Yule. And it was a really great exposition.
Oh, my God. That wasn't actually part of Millennial at that point. That was a Skype recording that I recall was quite difficult to record. I mean, nowadays I would just do that as a live hangout. In those days, I tried to, you know, it's far more anal about these things. But, yeah, that was a nice conversation. And I remember, actually, what was quite interesting about that was that I did one about the paganism and Yule, and then a second hangout, sort of sister piece to it, about Christianity and Christmas. And the Yule one was much more animated and sort of impassioned and enthusiastic. Just the participants. I guess it was just the choice of participants, but it didn't create the best impression of Christianity, I have to say.
Well, I'll just leave it at saying that that particular conversation that I referenced was a terrific conversation, a high watermark, and I really recommend that people go check that out. I'm glad to see, of course, Survive the Jive being a perennial part of Millennial returning this year. His work has certainly been really influential on me. But no matter, you know, look, we come from, there's different aspects of the European story, different cultures within our wider culture, different beliefs. As long as you're in touch and in tune with our general ethnoculture, and that's what I'm big on reviving and learning about myself. I'm not saying I'm an expert, but I'm kind of learning in public and sharing things as I go, because I think we need to remember these things, re-piece them together, and celebrate them together. That's essentially what I'm getting at, what I'm saying right now, is that Millennial, part and parcel to this time of year, is a celebration and kind of a gathering together of being a little more intimate. And maybe it's because our ancestors had to kind of hole up together in the winter, tell each other stories, survive together, and have that faint hope of the light coming back. That winter solstice it's kind of like that regeneration of the light is there at the lowest point. We know that after the winter solstice, it's going to go and get lighter from there for the next 6 months. Kind of, it's our own lived experience, Western lived experience of a yin yang, of experiencing that little bit of the opposite within the darkest part of the year is still that hint of the light and that promise of regeneration and growth. But times like that, certain holidays and certain festivities like this, it takes you out of your normal day-to-day life. That's why, you know, we need celebrants and we need holidays. We need festivities to mark special times that take us out of our day-to-day life. let us rejuvenate and return to that with a fresh perspective. And so what I see you doing, what you've done, I mean, there's a lot of different people in our spheres. I can't say I know all of them. You know, there's so many YouTubers out there. It's hard to keep track of. It's great that you are able to introduce some new faces and bring in some different perspectives. Obviously, you bring in a little bit, you pepper in a little bit of people who don't agree with us. And that's good. That reminds us of the fact that we need to keep ourselves sharp and have these conversations with other people and understand other perspectives. And yeah, let's face it, there's an entertaining aspect to that as well. And then also, you do have people who are more amenable to our ideas. They're definitely not coming at it from an adversarial perspective, but are still kind of dipping their toe in it. And one conversation that I think was a great example of that last year was with Critical Condition. That was one of my favorites from last year because, you know, she doesn't, I don't know where she is now. I can't speak for her, but she certainly at the time last year didn't profess quite the same kind of racial, ethno-cultural lens that a lot of us do. She nonetheless came on this show, which just being here says a lot, and then was able to have this open conversation with you. And I remember her telling this story about being in Ireland and visiting pubs and seeing Irish people sing these old songs and how everyone would kind of stop and there was a reverence for these old songs and their tradition. And you made the point to her that that's not going to continue without the people. And you could hear the people themselves and you could hear her pause and wrestle with this and think about it. And so you're also serving as a bridge to some of those people who maybe don't share the entire worldview that we do, but at least are willing to be open to it and talk. And I think it says a lot that she's back this year. I definitely look forward to that again. I'm glad to see that she's back in general. But then, of course, the main thing, the big meaty part of this is that most of us are here because we do care about white well-being and we do see that there's something going on in the white Western world. And you yourself, you might be British, and being British is closer to you and it's more in your local day-to-day experience. But there's a reason that we're talking across the Atlantic right now. Jason and I, on our show, The After Party, we speak to Parrish from Australia. We speak to Poseidon from Greece, Dancing Dove from Ireland. We're speaking to people from all around the world, Boer Republic from South Africa. We spoke to when I rejoined this week on the alt-right for a couple of weeks in October. Why is it that we're having all these conversations and tuned into each other around the world?
And why is it so easy to tune into each other as well? Because I always find it just basically effortless.
Yeah, we recognize a shared history, a shared destiny, a shared purpose, and frankly, we're under attack, a shared attack right now. And yeah, there's a reason for all of this. Now, someone might say, well, the internet makes it easier, and that's true. But I was thinking about this, and even in the earlier days of the internet, maybe 5 years ago, there's always been people who check in with each other in other countries. But a lot of that is because of finance. You know, you might be checking in, I'm as an American, might be checking in as to what is happening in Britain because I'm an investor or I work for a company and we're worried about, well, the political situation in Britain, how's it going to affect our bottom line or how is it going to affect stocks in the United States? I'm pretty sure you're not secretly a day trader or currency trader. I could tell people I'm not. We're not having these conversations because we're concerned about bottom lines. We're concerned about our culture. We're concerned about our ethno-culture. That's why we're having these conversations around the world, people of European descent around the world. So that is the common denominator. That's where the buck stops. And that is mainly what this is about. All of what we do is about throughout all the year. But millennial is one of the ways, I was saying before, I don't know every single YouTuber, so maybe I'm sure there are other people that do these holiday specials and my hat's off to them. But millennial really is one of the premier, if not the premier, gathering that people who care about what we care about, everything that I was just saying about white well-being, kind of check in, review the year, celebrate things together, look forward to the new year together. And that's exactly, that is in a weird way, even though I know people lament the certain trappings of online culture and the digital age, we're using what we have. We're using the tools that we have. This is the day and age that we live in. And this very much is in a weird way. You might not think of this word at first, but there is a folk consciousness to this. This is us doing what we do in December. This is us marking the Yule. This is the kind of things our ancestors did at Yule. We're just responding to it. We're responding to the circumstances of the world we live in, and we're using the tools of the world that we live in, this machine that I'm talking to you on right now, to do so. But the instincts remain the same. And that is ultimately what I'm about, getting back in touch with. The expressions may be different because we meet different stimuli in the day and age we live in, whatever pressures are on us at the time. But there's instincts, there are intuitions that we have that are in us and live in us, and they're expressing through the kinds of things that you do here.
When it's worth talking about how it started, actually, because it certainly wasn't deliberate. It wasn't conscious. Funnily enough, the 2015 general election in Britain is instrumental in this. I started the channel in January 2014, and I didn't do any hangouts. I'd never done a hangout. I had no idea about that kind of thing. I was fairly new to YouTube, actually. Certainly as a content creator, I was completely new to it, really. And so I didn't do any hangouts in 2014. But then in May 2015, people were, like, by that time, there was a fair subscribership, I think about 1,500 people. And they were asking me to, because that's the thing, the channel didn't grow. It was very much an esoteric channel, and it still is in some ways. And so it wasn't, I wasn't going out of my way to meet, to get as many people on board as possible, but it nevertheless happened, and it was a very tight-knit community, certainly in those days. And they really wanted to communicate with each other. They really wanted to have hangouts, and they kept saying hangouts, and I didn't really know what they were talking about at first. Then I looked into it, because I thought, well, there's general elections coming up, and so I'll find out what it is. And so we ended up doing, I think, 3 or 4 hangouts, one a night, and they were completely undisciplined because, well, they would be. They were my first. And they went on for like 5-6 hours each, and they were open to everyone, the public, and which was just total chaos. But people really enjoyed them, and I really enjoyed them, although they were exhausting, as you would expect. Anyway, then that Christmas, that December, I decided to do a similar thing. I think I hadn't done any other hangouts in the interim. And that was when I came up with the name Millennial, which was obviously a play on, well, I don't need to describe, no, I don't need to explain it. And they were the same as the May hangouts. They were open to the public, and that was it. They were just going to be sort of chaotic. But well, my notion was that it would be a relaxed end-of-year thing, because 2015 was a fairly disturbing year. I mean, that was the migrant crisis, and we were still getting over Rotherham and ISIS and all that stuff going on, and Charlie Hebdo and all this. So it wasn't a very nice year. And, what year is these days? And so it made sense to just have something at the end of the year that wasn't combative or whatever. It was just something for us to relax around. Well, what ended up happening was that because the hangouts were open to the public, I posted the URL publicly. Sargon of Akkad gate crashed the very first Millennial hangout in December 2015, and that made it a big thing, because then, not just in terms of the viewers that he brought in, but it changed the tone totally. Because then I started thinking, okay, well, let's, each of these hangouts should have a focus. It should have a special guest. And so rapidly, very, very quickly, I managed to arrange Richard Spencer and Jared Taylor and Greg Johnson. And I think some of the TRS guys as well did. Yeah, they did one as well. And that was all just off the cuff, arranged in the aftermath of the Sargon hangout. So that was how it started. And then in the next year, 2016, I made it far less chaotic. They weren't open to the public. Each one was just a guest, a one-to-one, like we're doing now. And it was fairly concise.
And I noticed that in 2015, that it was all hangouts with multiple people.
on air. Some of them were ridiculous. I mean, they had 10 people in there. And you just can't, you can't marshal that. Some people like them. I don't like things like that, because I think it's very rare that that ends up being a video that anyone would watch after the fact. And I don't like that. Seems like a wasted opportunity. There's a lack of focus. But sometimes it does happen. I mean, that Sargon hangout from 2015, people will watch that because it was a seminal moment in the relationship between the skeptic community and the alt-right. So it does have rewatch value.
Now that you have a set tone with the interviews, do you think you might have a few hangout, like spontaneous impromptu hangouts this year?
I don't know. I might. And I should say that I kept the same formula for 2017 as 2016. But 2017 was much bigger. 2016 was, I think, 24 hangouts. Last year, 2017, I think it was about 60. And then this year, 72. Yeah. But I should say that some of them are pre-recorded. I didn't mention this before. While you were talking, I came up with a list of things that I should have had in the notes. One of them is that there are about 12 pre-recorded hangouts this year, done for logistical reasons that I don't need to go into. But they'll be put up on the 15th and the 21st. And there'll also be one the Greg Johnson one will go up, I think, in 2 nights from now. So, but yeah, you were asking about hangouts throughout the year. Maybe, but I like the idea of keeping it as something for people to look forward to throughout the year, because they do seem to. I mean, I didn't realize that it had actually become something that people outside of the ethno-nationalist sphere, they talk about it as well. It's become, and I don't want to boast, I might well be wrong, I might well have misheard, but from what I've heard, it is something that people know about in like in the civic nationalist community, for example, and in
maybe
the skeptic.
It's a target-rich environment.
yeah.
We'll see.
Indeed. But doing them throughout the year, I don't know. It's a fucking big, complicated.
Well, that's not what I was asking, actually. It was in December, this December, if you would pepper in a couple of hangouts with a few people that are on schedule.
Oh, I see. Well, if people want to take part, and then they can email me. But the same rules apply. You've got to have a project, or you've either got to be a public figure yourself or have a project, like a YouTube channel or a podcast, etc. And it doesn't need to be big. You can be just starting out, but you've got to have something to show, and it has to be good quality. Those are the rules. If people want to take part, then I'll see if I can squeeze them into the schedule. There are three slots. That's another thing I wanted to say, is that there are three or four slots still free yet to be occupied, because there are several people, like Black Pigeon Speaks, for example, hasn't been able to schedule yet. Electra hasn't been able to schedule yet. I tried to get Mike Enoch, but he was not terribly responsive. I think he was very busy. There are several people that I would like to have got on, but haven't yet booked, and it might still happen or it might not. I don't know. But yeah, the schedule probably will evolve throughout the next, it's 2 weeks. It's only 2 weeks. That's the thing. It's not a long time, but it's going to be jam packed. Sure.
Well, time kind of morphs in this, in December. That's the thing about December, not feeling the same than the rest of the year, what I was getting at a little bit when I was speaking earlier. Another thing about your channel that I think makes this work is I believe that people are online in this sphere for two basic reasons. One is the more intellectual side of actually all trying to learn together and figure out what the hell happened in our Western European civilizations and how to get back on track. And you know, that is no small task, and it's probably going to take generations to figure out. But we're somehow all part of this and asking questions and figuring that out. So there's the intellectual side of it. And then there's also the social aspect of it, because all of these YouTubers, it is kind of just this crazy cast of characters. And sometimes people just like to participate in the chats and see what happens on these live streams to see how these different personalities combine and clash. And there's that element of it as well. And I think that your channel does a good job of bringing those two worlds together, those two strands together of why people get online and get in these chats to begin with. But it strikes, I think you strike the right balance because you don't veer off too much into it being about the social side of it, because then that becomes a secondary product where it's only you're doing content like shows that are just about the latest gossip and personality clashes.
I think it's very important not to get into that. I really have a strong aversion to that. Yeah, no. The gossip and the rumor mongering and all that.
Bollocks. Yeah, yeah. As do Jason and I on the After Party on his channel, No White Guilt. But you're tuned in enough, Woes, where I feel like you have a good handle on who's out there and people kind of gravitate to you, so that there's a little bit of that where people can still kind of get a lay of the land of who's out there and hear these interesting conversations. So I'm not saying you're a gossip show, because obviously you're not.
Oh, no, I thought that's what you, when you used the word gossip, no. I thought you were talking about this. Sorry if I reacted too strongly there.
No.
It is, I mean, it's always a choice. Like, each millennial is basically up to the guest what they want to talk about. And if they want to talk about their project, or if they want to talk about the year that's been, or they want to talk about some particular topic, then that's all fine. It's up to them. But what I certainly wouldn't allow is someone to just come on and bitch about other YouTubers or something like that. That's absurd. And I just don't think it's healthy.
Yeah, any amount of attention that may be garnered to certain personalities, as I said, that's still a secondary thing. And we have to remember that you still want to be looking at what it is they're talking about, what their content is, how they might be teaching people or inspiring people or giving new perspectives or giving you tools in your own life. When you're dealing with other people online that don't think like we do, dealing with your friends and family in real life that don't think like we do, that we're kind of booing ourselves up and giving ourselves ammo for these intellectual conversations, because it is a metapolitical battle. I know that's said often, but it is true. And we're all kind of teaching each other and learning together, putting pieces together. So as long as it leads back to that, that's fine. I know sometimes people just do like, again, personally, it's not my style, but people, let's be honest, there are people that do show up to these chats sometimes or do tune into different shows because they're interested to see what's going on. It's kind of like this, wrestling, professional wrestling sometimes, like all these crazy characters who are on YouTube. And there is a certain fascination that people do have with the clash of personalities and what they're up to.
I remember last year, the Kraut thing was going on at this time, and somebody put together an image of the four people who had responded to his videos against the alt-right. And it was me, JF, and Braving Ruin, and of course, the Alternative Hypothesis. And they'd plastered our faces onto people, like a family Christmas photo. And it was very funny. But it occurred to me how ridiculous, how incongruous these four characters are. Like me, JF, Alt-Hype, and Braving Ruin. There was no sort of unifying aesthetic to these four different channels. And that sort of amused me and baffled me. But it just illustrates that, that, as you say, characters is sort of the word. Because however you conduct yourself on YouTube, you do end up presenting a thing to the world, which could be described as a character. Whether it's fictitious or not is another matter, of course. But it is a particular thing. And so you end up with a certain aesthetic and a particular attitude and particular accent and all the rest of it. And so you add these four very different people there. And I think that's indicative of what YouTube in general is like. I mean, every new channel is a new character to get to know. And, how open each YouTuber is in that regard is up to them, of course. So some people are very guarded. But, and I guess those are the types who probably wouldn't come on Millennial. But that's fine. But yeah, it is an opportunity for people to, I mean, the other thing is that it's an opportunity for people to discover things that they haven't heard about yet and that I haven't heard about yet. I mean, there are channels appearing that I have not yet watched, except to sample them to gauge their quality. But otherwise, I'm not familiar with them. And podcasts as well.
That's the spirit in which I was saying when I was talking about the who's out there. I was saying that some people get attracted to the social aspect and the characters, and I use the word gossip. And that's what I was. That's the spirit of what I was getting at before. Obviously, again, you're not a gossip monger, but what I guess you're doing is you're aggregating here at the end of the year.
It's inevitable. It's inevitable that people are going to be interested in the social aspect of it, because of course they are. I mean, you know, this is a community.
Yeah, and what you're doing, what you were just speaking to, is you're curating. And this is a good time to discover new people as well. Obviously, as I spoke to in my own life, you helped make the most significant connection that I made in 2018 and changed the course of what I'm doing in connecting with my good friend Jason of No White Guilt and doing the after party.
And I'm very glad that happened. I'm gratified to have been of help there.
I've said that at other points throughout the year. I like people to know that because I'm big into being grateful and honoring people and saying, hey, look, this guy doing this good work, it's having these actual results. You know, you've had thousands of others. I'm just explaining how it affected my own life. But what you're doing is curating at the end of the year. And I'm like, I looked at your list, a lot of people I'm not familiar with. I'm interested in the people that are doing this in real life stuff, the 100-handers. You're going to be speaking to these guys that they're kind of this loose network. Yeah. And then there's one guy that approves it and they do stickers. And then you can take a picture of the image on the sticker and it'll lead you to like Red Ice or something like that.
And I thought that was such a clever idea. It's a great idea.
Yeah. This is the kind of stuff we have to do, because transitioning out of this talk about the social aspect of all this is, as I was saying, you can get people's attention with that social aspect, but ultimately what is it in the service of? You know, it's just masturbatory if it's not in the service of that duty of addressing what is going on in the world right now that we've been born into. And that is, we are in a civilizational crisis. And, you know, we have to approach that with the sobriety that it needs. But that doesn't look, we're still living our day-to-day lives. And it doesn't mean that we can't also inject a sense of even joy about it. And kind of this, like this sense of fate, like this was the time that we were born into. And I know it's very easy to get blackpilled by all the negative news stories out there, but this is the time you were born into. You were born into a crucial point in European civilization's history. And that could be daunting and you could be drowned by that, or that could be the most inspiring thing that you could ever imagine. And I choose the latter, and I encourage people to choose the latter as well. So speaking about that, the social aspect hopefully doesn't overshadow that. That's what we're all here for, and that is ultimately what this is all about. And it doesn't mean that we can't make the occasional joke along the way. I'm enjoying this. I'm smiling right now, even as I'm talking to you. I always enjoy talking to you and doing this. But we have to understand the backdrop against what this all is. And that relates to what the big thing of this year that I agree with you on is that I think that this year in 2018, we had to realize, the people online had to realize more, that this is a marathon and you do have to be in it for the long haul. I think some of those lessons happened through real life events like Charlottesville and some of the campus speeches in 2017. This year, 2018, we saw the effects of online censorship. We saw the effects of deplatforming. And we have to whittle our way around new clever ways to circumvent that and to do more in real life, to connect more in real life. That's why I mentioned the 100-handers. So that's kind of been, that's how to connect those two things too.
Yeah. What I would say about this, another thing to say about the social aspect is that it's really come to the fore in the last 2 months, in the midst of all the deplatforming that's been going on. And certainly, just I'll talk about the Twitter thing just one more time, and I'll keep it very brief, I promise. As I said before, one of the worst aspects about being banned from Twitter was suddenly being disconnected from, I don't know, dozens of good friends and hundreds of other friends, and of course, thousands of followers. And I really resolved at that point to make sure that could never happen to me again. And so I got everyone onto other, like I linked with people on other things like Skype and Telegram and so on. But that was in, again, that's sort of in, indicative of something that I think everyone, it's occurred to everyone over the last 2 or 3 months that we are being deplatformed all over the place. And so we have to network. It's weird the ways that this comes up. Like people in the pre-records that I did over the last week, loads of different people mentioned this, that they that this need to create real life communities, not just to network online and to do it more reliably, but also to create real. I mean, there's a definite focus now on creating things in the real world that was not there 6 months ago, let alone last millennium.
Yeah, that's been, as I said, I think the fallout of this year of 2018, realizing that we are in enemy territory and we have to think like guerrillas. We should obviously have known that well before 2018, but anyone who only spends their time online and is only plugged into the digital world, maybe they were turning a blind eye to some of that. And now it's apparent with everything that's gone on with the deplatforming that we have to think of ourselves as guerrillas. We have to understand the lay of the land, be realistic about it. We do not have any kind of social and political clout in the real sense of the word. And we have to realize and how to maneuver around that.
Oh, absolutely. And it's going to be different because one of the things, of course, that working online brings us is the ability to communicate with people in every different country on earth instantaneously, as you and I are doing right now. Obviously, that's something that we're going to have, well, we'll not attend real life work, real life networking, which is going to be different. But, that's what people did before the internet. So I think we'll handle it fine. It is interesting that this, people have been isolated for so long. God knows what it must have been like for people. Well, I do know what it was like because I was isolated for so long before all of this started. And I first got into these ideas in 2002. And it was a lonely time. And then I got into the Daily Telegraph blogs at the end of that decade. And then they became cucked. And then I discovered the Reactosphere, which then morphed into the alt-right, which has now morphed into, well, is in the process of morphing into something else. I would say, I don't know if you want to go into that, or that's a bit of a tangent perhaps. But anyway, the point is that, yes, it is a lonely life. And I get contacted by many people who don't know anyone yet. They listen to podcasts, they watch YouTube channels, they might read blogs and whatever, but they haven't made themselves known yet. And they might never do that. Maybe they're not that type of person. And so they feel very isolated, alienated in their real lives. Well, I think that those people really need to be reached and accommodated somehow, because why not? And if we can do that safely without endangering ourselves, then we should do that.
Sometimes I think about methods that are online, but maybe turn back the clock a little bit and aren't reliant on the current social media that we know. Not to say that we get off social media. We have to use it however we can. But I'll give you a simple, simple example that might sound archaic to some people at this point. And that would just be an email list. Like my site is hosted outside of the United States. It's also hosted in a non-EU country. And from everything that I've researched, nothing is bulletproof, but it does afford me a certain bit more of protection. And so my email list can go through that, and if people sign up to it, this is something I'd like to encourage people to do more as my own audience grows. If I have all of your email addresses, then if something happened and there, like a bomb was dropped and tomorrow I wasn't on any social media and just all my profiles were nuked, I would still have a way to reach out to you and tell you this is what happened. Or let's say Woz had an email list of 10,000 people. You could say, this is what's going to be different about millennial this year. We have to be a little more careful, blah, 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 blah. So simple as it may sound, old school as it may sound, if you can get on lists like that, that have hosting based in, safer countries or encrypted, whatever the case may be, let's not make it more complicated than it needs to be either. All we need to do is be able to get in touch with each other. And in terms of finances, all we need to do is some kind of encrypted safe app where people can send each other money, which is people have a right to do, to send each other money.
Well,
from checking account to checking account.
Yeah, I hardly need to get into how ridiculous and outrageous it is that what's been done to our community over the last 2 years, especially since Charlottesville, and then especially over the last, I just heard that Gavin McInnes has lost his YouTube channel now. So that's him literally wiped off the internet. He doesn't have a single thing. He doesn't have Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and he's lost his job with Blaze Media as well. So he's completely fucked, just like Alex Jones. But it happens to much more lower profile figures than him as well, that this is terrible and it is persecution. I don't think that that is too strong a word. It has certain connotations that are over the top. No, we're not being hounded physically, you know, run through the town or whatever, but we are certainly, they're trying to silence us. And also they're trying to demoralize us. That's a big thing as well.
One thing that occurred to me a little before the show today is it's a federal offense in the United States, and tell me if this is true in Britain, it's a federal offense to tamper with mail. So if the mailman...
Yes, it belongs to the Queen until it's delivered. It's the Queen's property, so yeah.
Okay. If I see a mail carrier and they have their back turned and I go take something out of it or I mess with it, that's a serious offense. And why is that? Well, it's because communication has consequences. I mean, back before any of this, this is, you know, the U.S. Postal Service, this is how people communicated with each other, got legal documents to one another before we were able to email them. So what you're able to communicate, both sending and receiving, has tremendous amount of consequences, could even be matters of life and death sometimes. So I'm wondering if there's a precedent that we can use to apply that to online messages, that your ability to communicate, to send and receive messages online would be protected under the same kind of precedence. Red Elephants, who I know is going to be on later, Millennial, they did a good video. Vince did a good video about, where is this? There's an act. I'll pull it up. There's an Arkansas congressman, Stop Social Media Censorship Act. There's an Arkansas representative here in the States that is trying to do what he can do to push through this legislation to be considered about internet sites being considered public utilities and people being able to sue the social media companies if they remove their posts. And that's what got me thinking about the mail carrier angle, because the government tells private companies what to do all the time as it is.
This idea that you can't interfere with private companies is just absurd. We do it all the time, every day.
I mean, here's the thing. If you came to the States and you and I wanted to start a company and our company, Woz, grew to a size of over a certain amount of people, then we would have to have a certain quota for diversity hires. Or something.
Diversity, diversity department.
I'll head it. Okay, yeah. We'll have blondes, redheads, and brunettes. That's my diversity. That's my diversity department, all right?
So, sounds like my kind of company.
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure doing business with you. We are told this line, private companies. Guys, get serious. Anyone who's maybe watching this that's outside of our fold, maybe you're more centrist, libertarian, what world are you living in? The government intercedes in private companies all the time. These Silicon Valley companies receive government subsidies. There's a kind of quotas that Woz and I were just talking about. They're telling you what days you can recycle your paper, how much water you could use. Like, give me a break. Governments intercede in private companies all the time. And there's also the whole idea with, just start an alternative. We've seen what's happened with that.
Oh, my God. I mean, look at BitChute and Gab. Travesty.
There's a certain point, I don't know, Stalin might have said this, but hey, a broken clock is right twice a day, right? There's a certain point where quantity takes on its own quality, right? I say this sometimes. I know water is still water, but an 8-ounce glass of water is different than the Atlantic Ocean. Sometimes quantity just, it becomes its own thing and it takes on new qualities. You know, you can't drown in an 8 ounce glass of water, but the Atlantic Ocean is a force of nature. So what if a private company, we'll go on the water example, here we go. What if a private company was the only firm in a country that could clean the water? Let's say the whole water supply in a given country was poisoned, and there was one private firm that somehow cornered the market and monopolized the ability to purify that drinking water. Basically, you would have the survival, the literal survival of the entire population in the hands of a private company. You're going to tell me that at that point, the government wouldn't step in to regulate and make sure that that company that's purifying the water wouldn't abuse its position? Of course. So we absolutely have grounds. We have philosophical grounds for calling these internet sites the digital public square. What I'm realistic about, what we all need to be realistic about, is the fact that it doesn't matter how well reasoned our arguments are. As I said earlier, we don't control the culture. We're in enemy territory. So legislature, lawmakers, police, anyone, media pundits, academics, they'll twist themselves in knots to justify the harm against us. And here's the thing that's interesting. You mentioned McGuinness. You know, I know there are more traditional, quote unquote, conservative types or MAGA types here in the States who get caught up in this. And I feel like they're still collateral damage, that the heart of the beast to them that they're going after are people like us who care, again, about European peoples, who care about European civilization, white well-being. So we have to pose that back to the more conservative types and centrist types. Why are we the target? Why is the GUI center with our ideas? Like, we're the final boss. We are where the party is. Why is that? Why is it that European peoples, European civilization, the European way of life is being targeted? Because to me, as I said, the others are collateral damage. It's the Western way, it's Western civilization that they're trying to dismantle and change. And if you can get some of these people to actually see that, then maybe there's a small chance that some flicker will go off in their head and you'll be able to start having them understand our perspective a little bit more.
Well, yes, that's a huge topic, and I don't even know what to say about it. I think that it is important to grow our numbers. It is important to reach out to people. I don't think that we need to... But this is something that I think a mistake was made over the last couple of years, that we got into this idea that we are a fringe group, a marginalized group, and we sort of marinated in it and insisted that people either agree with us 100% or they're cucks and, you know, losers and all the rest of it. And I think that shrillness didn't help us and was silly in and of itself. And I think that, but it also goes hand in hand with being a fringe group. You do end up marinating in how persecuted you are and so on. I think it's something that we have to get over because it's not attractive to the outsiders, to normies, as we call them. But that is, I mean, it is essential that we grow our numbers because I remember when I got banned from Twitter, the thing was, okay, how many people do I have to, how many divisions has Millennial Woes? Not many. Whereas bigger channels that are more popular, more mainstream, they have hundreds of thousands of subscribers. So it's a question. I'm not saying that I'm going to cock and go mainstream or something. I'm just saying it's a fact that we do need to get these people on site to at least to defend us, if not to agree with us, to defend us. And they're not going to defend us if we have spent, you know, years making their lives difficult and annoying. We need to foster relations with other communities and not be so belligerent, I think. And I know that people will say that that in itself is cucking because these people are weak or whatever. They don't realize how serious the situation is. Yes, I agree that they don't realize how serious the situation is. But remember that they are intelligent human beings as well, and they do deserve respect. This is something that's been on my mind a lot. Over the last, well, it's been on my mind since last 2 years, really, but definitely over the last few months, as we become more endangered as a social media species, I think that we really need to look at ways to survive, because they're coming. We all know that they're coming for us. Something that I didn't say at the start that I meant to was that they're this, and I'm not sure if I should talk about this, but it's this channel got a strike. There were five channels. I mentioned it in the Erkenbrand speech, Machinery of Silence. There were five channels that got a strike on the same day. And BPS, Black Pigeon was one of them, and Red Ice, and Matt Forney, and The Killstream, and me. All on this, I think on the same day, or within like a 36-hour period. Black Pigeon and I had never had a channel strike before, ever. Yeah, I've been going for nearly 5 years. He's been going for, I think, 2 or 3 years. Never before had this happened, and then it happened. Now, before I realized the other ones, I thought it was just me, and I thought, okay, this is about millennial. Because as some people will know, when you get a channel strike, you are banned from live streaming for 3 months. So I thought, okay, this has been done so as to scupper millennial. But then I discovered that four other channels had been done as well. And then the weird thing was, and this happened after the Erkenbrand speech, I appealed the thing, and it worked, because indeed it was completely unjust. It was ludicrous. It was all about a video that I made in September 2017 about Charlie, the children of Charlie Hebdo, it was titled. And I appealed, and it worked, and I was very surprised indeed. I didn't even get an email from YouTube about it. I just happened to go to my channel status page one day, about, I don't know, 3 weeks ago now, and there was no evidence of the strike. It was just gone. It was back to normal. And it said, you have no community guideline strikes, and it said you can live stream. And the video had been reinstated as well. So it was just sort of out of the blue. I was not notified about it. And so that meant, oh, millennial can go ahead as a live thing. Prior to that, I thought it's either going to have to be streamed on some other website. Stream.me would be the obvious choice. And that will be the obvious choice if something goes wrong on YouTube during the next 2 weeks. Either that, or I'm going to have to pre-record them all and put them up as YouTube premieres, which would mean that there would be a live chat, but there would be no interacting with the audience and between the audience and the guests. And it would be onerous. It'd be fucking onerous to do it that way. It'd be better than nothing, but it would be not nearly as good as live streaming. So that's what I was going to have to do. Or just cancel it, because it would be, you know, and I did consider cancelling it. That was, I thought, do I really want to put myself through this? Anyway, in the end, that wasn't necessary, because the strike was lifted. So, but the other four channels didn't get their strikes lifted, which makes me nervous, because I'm thinking, okay, is this a trap? I wanted to make a video explaining all this to people, but in the end, there was just so much work to do over the last 2 weeks that I couldn't do it. It does make me nervous. It's like, are they waiting for me to make a mistake so that they can just terminate the channel or something like that? Because the kill stream, see, I'm going into perhaps unnecessary detail. I should have done this in a separate video. I apologize. The apparatus for live streaming was disabled on my main channel, because that's the one that had got the strike. But it was still available on my MW Live channel. But YouTube say that if you do this, if you use another channel to live stream, then you're circumventing the ban and they will terminate you. So I thought, are they tempting me to use my live channel to do this so that they can then terminate everything? This is the atmosphere now, right? This is the climate. You have to be really on your toes. About
it's like they're playing whack-a-mole.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they're making the rules up as they go along as well. I mean, it's ridiculous. And of course, there is no one, there's no number that you can call, there's no human being that you can interact with about this at all. And I understand the volume, the sheer volume of complaints and stuff that they're dealing with every day. Yeah, I get it. You know, they don't want to... The complaints department, if they were staffing it with human beings, would be, you know, I don't know, 500,000 people. I don't know how many would be necessary. So I can understand why it is the way it is, but it's still ludicrous. I'm sure that there are things they could do to cut down on these, what would you say, fatuous reportings of people's channels and so on. And I think it should just be far more difficult to get someone's channel taken down. And as for a ban on live streaming for 3 fucking months, just as the punishment for your first strike, that is outrageous. 3 months. Red ISO.
I got that.
Yeah. It's outrageous. Yeah. I 3 months, I mean, 3 weeks would be bad enough. Some people live off live streaming.
No, they shouldn't be allowed to do this.
It's just outrageous. Yeah.
That's the point.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, that's why it's so draconian. But again, I think that they should simply be legally prevented from doing this to people because they are literally ruining people's livelihoods. I'm not going to say they're ruining people's lives, but, well, in some cases there are. We've yet to, as far as I know, we've yet to hear of the first suicide caused by deplatforming, but it will happen.
And if they did, they wouldn't shed any tears because it's, well, someone on our side would be the wrong kind of person. So we know, again, how it goes, that up is down, down is up, whenever it suits their purposes. My own was just for a placard, an image with no sound directing people to a conversation that we'd had on the after party over on Jason's channel on No White Guilt with Elect and JF. And it was, the title was something like, they debate something about porn, okay? And that's a live stream that was on No White Guilt on that channel. I'm just directing my subscribers. I would think my subscribers know what's going on over there, but just in case, I wanted to direct them to it. Sound this video, just a little image with Elect and JF and saying, hey, now it's up on No White Guilt's channel. You can go listen to the recording. And I got a strike on that. And I appealed it saying, well, maybe some kind of bot thought it saw the word porn and it saw a link and thought that I was directing it to another website. You know, I was trying to direct people to porn or something. And I was like, no, this is an intellectual debate that I participated in about the subject of porn, but didn't matter to no avail. That was back in September though. So the strikes just lifted. And then there's all kinds of stuff. Like we spoke to Zurius, the musician, and he has, he's getting strikes or he's having trouble with videos that he even has on private, I believe, or there are certainly people who are dealing with things like that. And of course he makes music that doesn't even have lyrics to it, but they realize that he is in our spheres and that he's part of this wider white well-being milieu. And that's, again, that is the question I would keep putting back to those who tiptoe around this or who are outright against us is why? Why are we the target? Why is there something so tantalizing about what we're saying? Doesn't that set off any alarm bells in your head? Doesn't that maybe want make you explore why that is?
There are obvious reasons why it is, and you and I won't go into them here. But another reason that I think people don't go into enough is simply that the left love to hate. They absolutely love to hate. They need something to hate. They need to hate us far more than we need to hate anyone. I mean, and really, I don't know people. I mean, I know some people in the nationalist community who are motivated by hate, but most of us simply are not. But lefties, the glee they take in, like when one of us gets deplatformed, the glee they take in condemning us and making fun of us and degrading us is really unpleasant to behold. And I think they are far more hateful than I really do think. I mean, I'm not just saying this as a sort of ironic play on words or whatever, but I think they are genuinely more hateful than we are.
Well, I'm glad you said that because you reminded me of something I wanted to say before when you were talking about your community, your outreach, and the kinds of people you speak to, is that there's a certain generosity of spirit that a lot of us have. Hopefully, you know, we live up to those better aspects of ourselves, and you certainly exemplify that on Millennial and the conversations that you're able to engage in and the different kinds of people that you're able to engage in. And, well, you know, I've seen things like fundraisers for people that are not exactly in our sphere, who maybe have some different political beliefs, but they got banned, they got doxxed, and it's us. It's our people who are rallying around them. When Chase Rachels, who has very different political ideas than we do, we'd spoken to him on this week on the Alt-Right, when Jason and I heard that he got doxxed, Jason and I had him on our stream on the after party. Laura T from Defend Europa came over and co-hosted with us. And we I'm very proud to say we raised several hundred dollars for Chase, and he was so touched. And we had debated about a lot of different things when he was on This Week on the Alt-Right a couple of months prior to that. And we didn't see eye to eye on many things, but we knew that he was coming from a genuine place. We knew that he was exploring these ideas. And we did know in that case, I do have to be honest, we did know that he does have the well-being of European peoples in mind. So we do share that common denominator, that most important common denominator. But I've seen people in our spheres come to the defense of the who we call conservatives, who wouldn't return.
Such a funny name.
They don't return our phone calls. They don't return our messages, but we will still stick up for them. You know, you outreach to Sargon, who some of his ideas, I have never listened to his material, but I went and listened to his video, The Ethical State, to get a better idea of what he's about. And it's interesting because a few of his ideas, as I said, it's I don't see that many degrees of separation between making that leap of where those ideas come from, realizing they came from European peoples, and connect that final dot. And you can't have societies that have this amount of freedom that don't have European peoples. They didn't develop, well, maybe they did. They did develop in a bit of a vacuum when Britain was more literally an island. These ideas have had the luxury of being developed centuries ago when we were not as connected as we are now. The last century of mass migration and mass technology has changed the game. So if you're still thinking in those ways, your thinking is a couple of centuries behind. We have to adjust and deal with the world as it is now. A lot to that, but I could see how his ideas, you are a couple steps away, whether it's him, maybe not him himself, but people who listen to him, you can make the case and walk them towards a more ethno-cultural understanding. Now, I do understand that he has said things like, screw white people and I hope you have a genocide. And even though I know he's trying to be a rash.
That was trolling of some kind.
I know that's trolling, but I'm sorry. I'll put him in touch with a girl I know who was raped in the UK. And we'll see how funny he thinks it is that we're living in a situation where she has an uphill legal battle because of the type of man who raped her because he was a migrant, and how she's explored the legal system over in the UK and seen how there's different sentences for people, whether you're white or you're a migrant, and there's a whole stack of cards against you. I don't buy it. He can screw himself if he said something like that. He's off my list, to say the least. I'm trying to keep it polite, but the fact that you reach out to him, The fact that you reach out to him, though. Hello. Yeah, well, he said something gross and reprehensible, so he deserves it. But the fact that you reach out to him and the fact that you have a dialogue with him, that says a lot. There's all kinds of people in our sphere that have that generosity and that openness, and we're supposed to be the hateful people. I think, unfortunately, a lot of our movement is kind of assessed by... And, you know, it's easy pickings for anyone who wants to be our enemy. That troll culture. And I understand troll culture, that people want to blow steam off. I understand that. But unfortunately, people will look at comments and they'll think that the comments in chats or on social media are what's driving the ideology or the milieu of what we're about. And I try to tell people sometimes, it's like, don't look at the comments. Look at people like us. Look at the people who are up here saying things and putting forth arguments and putting forth perspectives. Frankly, I know for myself, for you, I know I could say for Jason and for some of our associates, it's definitely coming from a place of love. And I don't say that to sound conciliatory or kind of, syrupy. Love can be severe. You know, when a parent loves their child, they also have to discipline their child. They have to give them boundaries. Love doesn't mean a free-for-all. You know, I go into that in great depth in an essay on love on my own site, if you're interested. But in a very real way, in a more holistic, well-rounded, multidimensional way, again, love doesn't mean, oh, do whatever you want, hippy-dippy. But what I think love really is, we are doing this out of love. We are doing this out of a love of our own people because we want our own people and our people's story to continue throughout time, much the way a parent loves their child and has to watch their child, nurture them, have them grow, assert boundaries for their child to grow. We want to reassert the boundaries, the borders, and boundaries and borders come up a lot these days, but they're not just physical, they're psychological, emotional, spiritual. We need to reassert our boundaries and understand who we are as a people, celebrate ourselves, get back in touch with our folk, our heritage, our customs, our culture, and regain that confidence, regain that sense of self, and again, celebrate. I like that word. That's what we're doing now. We're celebrating. And I go to bed every night with a clear conscience because I know that I'm doing something that is right. And I know that I'm not doing something that is motivated in just blind vitriol. Yeah, there's times to get angry. I get angry. But the core of this is coming from a place of true love.
Yeah, I think that that's something that we really, our opponents could really do to hear, because they do have it in their heads that we are simply hate mongers and sort of fanatics bent on finding something to hate because it makes us feel better about it. I mean, they've got these ridiculous cliches that you need to feel superior. You feel superior to everyone who's not of your group. And you need to do that because you're insecure, because you've got a small willy, or you live in your mother's basement or something like that. They have these absurd caricatures of us. But the main one is that we are just hate mongers. That for some reason, we have this pathological need to hate. And it's amazing when you talk in support of your own people, you're assumed, well, that is translated in the liberal's head to you hate everyone else. And that is a preconception that I think we have to do our utmost to dispel. It could not be more untrue.
Yeah, and there's a fine line to walk between we dispel it, but in an affirmative way, by just pressing on, putting one foot in front of the other, doing what we do boldly, not by acquiescing. I wouldn't want someone in the audience listening to this thinking that we are advocating for some kind of cuckery or some kind of, well, we have to explain ourselves to the left so they understand us. I know I can't speak for you. I wouldn't think you're saying that. I'm definitely not saying that.
I'm not saying ask for that approval. No, I'm not saying ask for approval. I'm saying simplify the situation by clearing the miscommunication and the misunderstandings. At least then they'll know where we are coming from, where we stand. I think right now they absolutely don't. Now, obviously, I'm not naive about this. I'm not saying that some awful academic somewhere needs to be told this stuff, because they know damn well this situation. I'm talking about the naive lefties who listen to them, who follow them, and who really know nothing. I mean, they hear what they hear in the BBC and believe it. And now you could call these people NPCs, normies, whatever. But either way, I think, again, the more people we have on our side who are at least understanding us, the better. Right now, I think we're still an exotic species, actually. I remember when, late 2015, when I was talking to Richard Spencer on Millennial, about this, and I said that we are, the alt-right at that time seemed like something that the mainstream didn't know how to interface with. I think I used the analogy of, this is sort of embarrassing, but it is fitting. I used the analogy of Data from Star Trek, because he was of a unique technology. So he could interact with common technologies, but they couldn't interact with him. He understood them, they didn't understand him. And I think that that was how the alt-right was in 2015. But that's partly because of our techniques and so on. But I think that situation still pertains to the way we are now, because I think the mainstream really don't understand us. I certainly think the general public are told things about us which are completely untrue. But mind you, at the same time, I think the instincts of the normal, ordinary man do align with ours. In fact, he is the one who is contorted by, you know, by modern culture into, you know, bizarre self-hate and self-sabotage and, what's the word? Ambivalence. about his own people's fate. That's the perversity, not our concern for our people's fate. That is the most natural thing in the world throughout human history and throughout the globe today, except for white people.
Well, yeah, it's a hostile elite and a different framework that's created this. That's the thing. They don't know how to interface with us because we're using different frames. And the only frame they've been told, the only way it's possible for someone to be getting up here and advocating for their own people, and let's be specific, this is only about white people. As a white person yourself, you have to be some kind of this toothless 90 IQ guy out in the sticks who hates everybody. And we need all kinds of people getting up and showing that there's white people of all stripes, of all intelligences, of all styles, who are recognizing what's going on. And we're going to put forth our positions. And we're going to, again, honor, defend, cherish, celebrate who we are, and recognize that the things we enjoy about our current societies and cultures didn't come out of thin air. These are ideas. They don't float down from the idea factory on the clouds into our heads. They're born out of our experiences and they live in us. They're who we are. That's why I like the term ethnoculture, because as I said when I was a newbie and spoke to you here last year, and it's a thing I'm still on, you break down what I'm about in one word and it's holistic, or it's seeing the harmony in things. So yeah, for the more high level discussion, I don't like to get people too confused, but for the more high level discussion, I would be remiss to not admit that you can go too far in that other direction. You can go too far and say, you know, it's only about if you have white skin and that's it. Well, there's a little more nuance to that, and it's important to get up here and sometimes acknowledge that, because if we don't acknowledge that, then the implicit assumption, it makes that implicit assumption easier, that we have this very one-dimensional, very narrow way of viewing the world.
A heartless and cold way of looking at things, which is right. Not the case.
Right. There's considerations of ethos, of culture, of how things are done. There's considerations of spirituality. It's all of these things together forming an experience of a people. And yeah, it can get a little messy, or it can get the edges can fray a little bit. It's harder to say that the English people or the German people are this one thing than an individual. Like, an individual is a more discrete entity. You know, a people over time, physical borders may change, and there may be different religious movements that happened in it. But there's still enough to discreetly determine a history of Germanic peoples, let's say, and more widely European white peoples, as opposed to Chinese peoples, or more broadly Asiatic culture. There's still enough containers and markers, and that means something.
If it's possible to do that for any other people who just any people who happen to not be white, then why is it just somehow miraculously not possible to chart the history, identity, and heritage and so on of people who are white? I mean, this is just utter nonsense. And I mean, I don't know how it should be very simple to point this out to people. Why is it that if whiteness is a social construct and there's no culture, there's no white culture, then what about blackness? And what about Chinese culture and all the rest of it? This is utter nonsense. And at this point, it should be so easy to point this out to people. I don't really know why it isn't.
There are a few things that are unique about white Western European civilization. And one of them is that our dynamism, our exploratory urge, actually makes us harder to pin down a little bit. The borders and the edges sometimes are a little fuzzier because we went out into other areas of the world physically, or we explored ideas. And there's in that little area of Europe, if you look at a world map, in that little area of Europe, a lot of stuff went on. And there are a lot of different philosophical movements. There are a lot of different religious movements. But it's it's that searching. This is the rub. It's that searching and that dynamism, which is an aspect of who we are, that in turn makes us a little bit harder to pin down. But these are the kinds of things that need to be explored and need to be articulated, lest people get confused and lest people fall for things like there's no such thing as white culture.
That's an interesting point. Could you elaborate on that point that you say it's harder to pin us down?
There'll be people that say, you know, as it bleeds more into the East and you get into Eastern Europe and Russia, and then I mean, this is a physical example, and sure, mental, philosophical examples too. But it gets more Asiatic as you go more into Russia, or the fact that European peoples went into the southern cone of South America, and it's like, how Western is that? Well, it's kind of half and half. It's like they mixed with the native population there. So it's not quite the same as Europe, but there's still certainly white European stock in the southern cone of South America. There's still aspects of Western civilization there. People will use things like that to say, well, there were different words for different races or different words for, you know, in South America.
We can operate this both ways. If the fact that Europeans went to are mixed with Persians and so on, then we can just write off Persians. They don't exist either then, because they merge into Europeans. What a shame.
Right. People will point out that certain ideas from Western culture came from the cradle of civilization in the Near East, and they'll use that as a way to say, well, there's always been this kind of Euro-Asia culture. There's all kinds of ways that people can blur the edges, and there's no perfect edges in nature, but that still doesn't mean that there aren't meaningful distinctions. And that's what I'm getting at. And that's why I'm saying here is that we need our people educated in things like this so that they have the immunity when they hear these kinds of arguments to push back on them and not just fall in line and say, well, I guess that's true. And I guess white people don't have a culture.
See, what I thought you were getting at is this problem, which I do think is actually a real problem, which is that white people either don't know their own culture. Like the modern American 17-year-old might be into, I don't know, some sort of music from the last 20 years or whatever, but they don't know their deeper identity, their deeper culture. And so this is how you can get away with saying white people have no, that there is no white culture. There's no white American culture. Now, on the face of it, that's obviously rubbish, because something must have resulted, some culture must have accumulated over the last few centuries in America, and it's the same in Britain and France and so on. But at the same time, you can sort of see the truth in saying that, well, the middle class, the white middle class, are very detached from things. I mean, they don't live off the land or whatever in the way that the working class do. Historically, the working class did. They do have a very consumerist culture, which is transplantable anywhere. It doesn't really arise, well, it doesn't directly arise. It's no longer reliant upon the traditions and conventions of centuries ago. So you can see why people say, because white people, especially the middle class, are deracinated and they don't take pride in their identity or whatever. So, the effect of that is that the culture sort of dissipates into just global consumerist culture. But at the same time, even the way they do that is uniquely white. I mean, it is something, it's European, and the guilt that they feel is completely unique to us. And the smugness and the desire to be clever and all that, it's all still very European.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because that is the other side of the coin. I would never sit here and say there's no such thing as white culture, but I also wouldn't sit here and say that there's not a lot more work that needs to be done. And that however far you want to trace it back, mercantilism, Puritanism, having some kind of millenarian messianic view that early Americans had and the effects that had, and certain strands of Christianity equating too much of your spiritual worth with your material worth, where your material worth would be the sign that you're blessed by God, and thus you do whatever you can to gain material wealth. And ironically, even if you lie, cheat, and steal your way towards material wealth. Once you get material wealth, then because you have the material wealth, it shows that you must be a godly person. And I guess that negates the lying, cheating, and stealing that got you to that place. Yeah, look, I'm an American, and I'm extremely critical of the consumerist strip mall culture here. It absolutely disgusts me. So I understand what you're saying, and I don't know how it's going to look, but I do hope that there is a more earthy, focused reconnection to our European roots. I know that politically, in some ways, American identity, and we touched on this last year, broke from Europe, and part of our identity is that break. But ethnoculturally, I think Americans need to get back in touch with their European roots. I love that one of our primary groups here is called Identity Europa, even though it's an American organization. Yeah. Europa is right in the name.
I want to emphasize that wasn't a jibe at American culture.
Oh,
or even it wasn't even, the criticism wasn't even specific to America. I just used the sort of stereotypical example of the American 17-year-old who's got, you know, got everything consumer-wise, materially speaking.
Yeah, and that's what they want. They want someone that doesn't have any roots. I told a story, a hypothetical story, when I was on JF last month, and I mentioned it again when Jefferson Lee was on the after party a couple of weeks ago, and I'll briefly paint that picture again here, and it's this. So imagine if you had a white boy, a white college student, and he starts dating an Indian girl. Okay, you were talking about Persia and even India. You know, there's some Caucasoid, there's some relations there, even our language, old Indo-European, going back to Sanskrit. So I'm going to take a culture that at least has some overlap with ours. And let's say his white liberal parents are all for it, and they're like, oh, exotic and whatever makes you happy, because that's how most parents are, a lot of parents. Let's say the Indian girl's parents are more hesitant, but for whatever reason, for the sake of example, they go with it. So the white boy and the Indian girl are dating. And let's say at some point, the Indian girl's cousin is getting married. And as an olive branch, as a way to be hospitable, the Indian family says to the girl and her white boyfriend, the white boyfriend and his parents can come and be guests at this Indian wedding. Okay? So you have white boy, Indian girl, they're dating. Indian girl's cousin's getting married. White boy and his parents go to this Indian wedding. What do they see when they show up at this Indian wedding? You know, they see brightly colored orange and pink sarongs and robes. They see the girls wearing the nose ring that attaches to the earring by that little chain. They see statues of elephant gods on the walls, or paintings on the walls, or statues on the tables. Call and responses in Hindi and Urdu, traditional Indian dances. When family gets up to toast the bride and the groom, maybe they're referencing famous romantic couples from Indian folklore and fairy tales, the Mahabharata. The white boy and his white parents are tourists at that wedding. It is not theirs. It will never be theirs. If they got together and had children, they would have to either give up one or both of their cultures. Okay, there's not enough overlap. So either they acquiesce to one or the other's culture, so they lose thousands of years of a trajectory of ethnoculture and genes, or they become global homo. You know, they move to a city and they're always on their apps, pushing the stroller down the street, sipping a latte from Starbucks. No culture, the kind of thing that you were just talking about, which I think they want for people, but especially white people, because we're the most headstrong. And honestly, I think that we're the ones standing in the way most to this kind of global homo consumerist culture. The flip side of this, to get to what you were saying, Woz, look at an average American wedding now, and I'm sure there's many in Britain that are like this. The way I describe it is that they're glorified high school dances. There's a DJ playing top 40 hits. People just stand around and drink, dance a little bit. Maybe they play, you know, the highlight of the evening is the DJ plays September by Earth, Wind, and Fire, and grandma gets up and dances and people take pictures. Oh, it's funny, grandma's dancing this old 70s folk song, funk song, not folk, but that's important, funk song. All right. That's not good enough. That is not European folk culture. I want to see European symbols. I want to see European practices. I want to see when people get up to toast, they're not the best man's not talking about some stupid story about how him and Johnny were players in college, but now Johnny's settling down at the old ball and chain. Oh, ha, 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 have another Budweiser. That's not good enough. That's not folk culture. I'm trying to paint a picture here because what we need to do
very amusing.
Is be in touch with our old stories so that someone gets up, and even if it's a bad poem, they wrote a poem about the bride and the groom, and they're referencing Robin Hood and Maid Marian. They're referencing things from our culture. There's imagery from our culture. The girls have the flowers in their hair, like you see at the Swedish Midsummer's festivals. That is what I'm talking about. And we're a far cry from that. And as a kid, I even had a sense of this. Even attending family and friends' weddings, yeah, the actual vows, that moment of the vows may have had beauty, may have been genuine. Thankfully, most of the people I know who got married stayed married. So I'm not trying to disparage that. But the actual sense of, and this brings us back around to where we started, now that I'm realizing this with speaking about millennial, is I'm big into a sense of creating mindfulness of special times or rituals, and a wedding is certainly a time that is not like other days, to create a sense of mindfulness. And this is something sacred. Not to say that a wedding has to be austere and super serious. It's a celebration, and there should be a time for celebrating and acting out. But the lack of ethnoculture, the lack of folk culture in that most people are experiencing, that they're not experiencing. This is something I've felt even when I was a kid, like there's something wrong here. There's something missing. This is like a wedding is something more sacred. I don't know why I was tuned into that. I guess that's why I'm doing this now as an adult, but I'm doing what I can to wake people up to the idea that that's not everything I just described is not something trite. It's not just another way to do a wedding. It's not just another product. Like I could do the high school wedding or I could do the more traditional folk wedding. We're so out of touch with the symbols and the rhythms and the myths of all of what came before us. And it's a holistic experience. You can't separate one thing. And it's going to take a while, but I'm hoping that what I do and what a lot of other people do are going to start to put the pieces back together, help people connect the dots so that we can actually experience these things. If I have a wedding, I don't want it to be a DJ playing top 40 hits. I want it to be something that feels very grounded and connected to our ancestors, and almost like your ancestors are there watching and you're honoring them through all kinds of whatever the rituals and symbols and language, however it would manifest.
Yeah, I can well imagine that. I certainly can't imagine you with a wedding, top 40 hits and all that. I don't think that would be you at all. That just seems totally incongruous. I suppose we should wrap up now because we've got 20 minutes before the eminent Sargon of Akkad is due to appear. We should go through the super chats. An amusing anecdote here is that last year, Millennial 2017, Super Chats had just started, and I didn't actually know about them, or I definitely didn't know that it was a sort of convention that when somebody does a Super Chat, you answer it. So last year, I think I actually ignored Super Chats last year. I'm not sure now, but that's my memory of it, at least. Obviously, since then, the whole internet blood sports thing took off in January, and it all became, you know, everyone knows what Super Chat is nowadays. So let's go through the Super Chats. I have some friends collating these for me, and a number of people are wishing us both Merry Christmas. Thank you very much. Happy holidays as well, of course. Let's see what else. Somebody's asking me to get Eric Stryker on. I'll try to do that, or if he wants to contact me, that would be very good. Let's see what else. Greg Johnson will be on. Have a look at the schedule. Right. Someone says, I look healthy. Thank you very much. I'm using a particular light that maybe makes me look less, you know, pallid than usual. Let's see. Okay. Yes. PewDiePie. I doubt it. A discussion between me and Aaron Cleary, perhaps. And then, yes. And someone says, leftists accuse others of their own evil that they hate. Yes, I think so.
A fair amount of projection going on sometimes.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think a lot of them, they, as I said earlier, they need to hate us far more than we need to hate anyone. So I think that when they talk about that we're so hateful, they really are. It really is classic projection. And one other thing that came up earlier, it's not to do with you, Jared, but I said that we're yet to see the first suicide from deplatforming, and people in the live chat went mad about that woman, Nazim, whatever it was, who went and shot up YouTube. The reason I didn't mention her is that I don't know whether she intended to commit suicide or whether it happened because, you know, she was, because of the attack didn't go as she planned it or whatever. So I don't know if that was intended as a suicide. Okay. So I think that's about it. Is there anything else that you would like to say, Jared?
Well, for the context of Millennial, I think we're ending on a good note of wrapping it up with the wedding example and tying that back to this little bit of folk practice we're doing now, which is honoring this time of year, collecting ourselves, inspiring each other, giving each other gifts in a certain way. So I'm glad we ended on that note. And I just want to thank you for being here. Thank you for having me here. And I look forward to what's coming up next. I'll point people's attention just to a couple things as we wrap up. As I mentioned, I do my own videos.
Yes, but I forgot to introduce you as the host of the after party. I'm sorry about that. I was sort of preoccupied with delivering the news items at the start.
Yeah, for anyone that doesn't know, as I said in the beginning, because of Millennial 2017, Jason of No White Guilt and I became aware of each other and began a very fruitful partnership, which lasts to this day and will last far into the future. We do a show called The After Party weekly on his channel, No White Guilt. He also has a book that's about to come out called Born Guilty. It's several books within a book. It's a very, very interesting. I'm sure he'll talk more about it when he's on your show, but I do want to mention that Born Guilty by Jason Kuna is coming out soon. I had my first article on Countercurrents published recently. We've spoken to Greg a few times, and of course I look forward to Greg here. Speaking about the folk spirit, it was about how the European spirit peaks through rock and roll. It peaks through even in the most strange areas that we wouldn't think. So it's about rock and roll and the European soul. I have something called the Euro Migrant Crisis Fact Sheet that's on my site. It's also on Defend Europa, and you're going to be talking to them soon. My site has a bunch of other things as well, other articles, poetry, but you can find it all at thegreatorder.com. That's where everything for me goes through. But again, Merry Christmas, glad Yule to everyone. I look forward to meeting some new people, some new connections through this. I look forward to speaking to people in the chat and being and participating when I can in the upcoming Millennial episodes. And I hope everything goes well, Woes, from this point forward.
Well, thank you very much. As I did describe earlier, it is a bit precipitous. I'm not sure if everything is going to go well, or if we're even going to be able to complete the schedule, but I'll do what I can. Also, I should have said earlier, the schedule is subject to change. Can't remember if I mentioned Black Pigeon. Yes, I did mention, and Electra and Mike Enoch. So keep checking the schedule each day. There might well be new people added to it. It depends what I think I can physiologically sustain. Now, that's about it. So I will see you in about 20 minutes. Depends. He might be late. I don't know. But I'll see you then with Sargon. In the meantime, Jared from The Great Order and The After Party and This Week in the Alt-Right. I know that you're sporadically.
I was a regular on, I have to thank Mark Collette. He gave me a shot when I was pretty new as well. I was on regularly from April to August. And then it just so happens right now, my schedule precludes me from being around at that time on Wednesdays most times. I did come back for two spots in mid-October when I did have that time free on Wednesdays. But of course, I would love to join up again. But Jason, my partner on the After Party, is of course a regular week in and week out on this week on the Alt-Right panel.
Excellent. All right. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Jared from The Great Order.
Thank you.
All right. And I will see you all in a little while. Bye for now. And I hope you all enjoy Millennial 2018. I'm glad it's off the ground now. See you soon.